The gigantic investments and industrial operations required to produce and refine oil meant that international oil companies often found it financially prudent to partner on projects, much as syndicates of Wall Street investment banks shared the risks of selling stocks and bonds. This pattern of co-investment and coexistence meant that global oil executives kept up steady contact with one another. It was a form of continuous diplomatic relations, involving both cooperation and dispute. BP and Mobil had embarked on a joint venture that would combine their European refining businesses. Brown introduced the idea of a full merger that would create the world's largest privately owned oil company. Noto shared Brown's view of Big Oil's predicament. "We need to face some facts," he said later. "The world has changed. The easy things are behind us. The easy oil, the easy cost savings, they're done." Noto was worried. He expected the environment to become more volatile and more competitive and more difficult geographically and geologically. Mobil had inherited a large share of the downstream assets of Standard Oil. The company operated adeptly on the commercial side of the oil business, wheeling and dealing, negotiating customer contracts, maneuvering amid price volatility and the like. It won major new upstream plays in newly independent Kazakhstan after the Soviet Union's demise. Yet Mobil was highly dependent on the profits generated by a single large natural gas field in Indonesia and offshore properties in Nigeria. Both countries were politically unstable and racked by violence. Late in 1996 and early in 1997, Noto and Brown held a lengthy series of secret meetings to design a full merger of their corporations. Their work climaxed at a long conference in the New York offices of the law firm Davis Polk & Wardwell. Yet as a decision point neared, Noto thought that Mobil might still be better off on its own. On March 28, 1997, he met Brown in Mobil's corporate jet hangar outside of Washington, D.C., and made it clear that we could go no further, as Brown recalled it. Brown felt that he had wasted a lot of time and effort. He flew back to London and announced to a colleague, "Well, we'd better think of something else." Plummeting oil prices compounded the pressures he and his peers faced. The causes of the price fall emanated from Saudi Arabia, the world's leading oil producer at about 9 million barrels per day of capacity at the time, and the leading source of American oil imports. After Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, Venezuela's government decided to break from the OPEC policy and produce as much oil as possible. It looked as if Venezuela might be trying to steal some of Saudi Arabia's American market share. The usurper attempted to almost double its oil production, from 3.2 million barrels a day to 5.5 million a day. For a while, the gambit worked. Venezuela gained more and more of the U.S. import market and replaced Saudi Arabia as America's number one outside oil supplier. In 1997, however, Saudi Arabia retaliated by authorizing a surge in its own oil production, a program explicitly designed to punish Venezuela and to establish a deterrent, as the industry consultant Edward L. Morse would describe it, to dissuade any other oil-rich country that might harbor similar ambitions. The Saudi production surge drove global oil prices to historic lows in 1998. By the end of that year, oil would fall to just $10 per barrel. Adjusted for inflation, that was the lowest price the world had enjoyed since the 1960s. Disciplined Exxon could weather such a sudden price collapse. After the cost reduction binge of the 1980s, Raymond had reduced Exxon's operating costs an additional $1.3 billion annually in the 5 years until 1997. Less efficient companies such as Mobil struggled. Nobody knew how long prices might stay so low. The long-term challenge of resource nationalism compounded the anxiety. All this coaxed Lou Noto back to the possibility of a merger. In June 1998, he attended a meeting with Lee Raymond organized by the American Petroleum Institute, API, the Washington-headquartered oil industry trade group. Raymond raised the possibility of a minor deal to combine Exxon and Mobil refinery operations in Japan. "Maybe we should talk about that," the Exxon chief said. "That and other things," Noto replied. Mobil's top management committee met in New York every Tuesday and Thursday. One morning that summer, Noto arrived and said, "Guess who I had dinner with last night? I had dinner with Lee Raymond." The news shocked his colleagues. Exxon was more than twice Mobil's size by revenue. Layoffs would be the one inevitable byproduct of such a combination, and the job losses would reach the highest ranks of the Mobil hierarchy. There was a massive anxiety, an executive involved recalled. They worried as well about the culture shift if conservative Exxon took charge. By comparison, Mobil had been loosely governed. That summer, John Brown advanced a fallback plan to merge with Amoco, the offspring of Standard Oil of Indiana, headquartered in Chicago. Brown and Lawrence Fuller, Amoco's chief executive, held a series of private dinners in a back room at Le Pont de la Tour, the London restaurant, where Fuller could smoke his cigarettes and we could all drink Pouligny Montrachet, as Brown recalled it. Remarkably, no one noticed. On August 11, 1998, they announced that their companies intended to merge, with Brown to be in charge of the successor corporation. The deal would create the largest corporation in Great Britain and one of the largest private oil companies in the world. Brown's announcement galvanized his competitors. It was as if the industry had been standing by, waiting for someone to make the first move. It felt like we had broken a dam, as he put it. Every North American and European leader of a large oil corporation seemed to conclude simultaneously that his company needed to merge to get bigger. Chevron and Texaco would soon combine, as would Conoco and Phillips, and Total with Petrofina and Elf.